Welcome to The Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views, as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress. One of the things that really causes people concern is, you know, the fact that at any given moment, there's a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt in the world. And people spend a lot of time hearing about all the bad things that happen when they use technology or that they can use technology. Their corporate, their work tells them, don't click the link, don't open the attachment. Well, I'm known for saying those things, at least. I don't know if either of you are sending those same messages. But there's this air of fear of doing the wrong thing and the impacts of doing so. And so today I want to talk about how we, I guess, the two sides of the coin of put yourself into a quote unquote secure place in the way you use technology versus spending some time to, you know, using the technology, using the things you've got, using the email and the web systems that you have and the applications that you have more openly, and preparing and understanding what happens when something does happen, putting the controls in place so that you can restore and get back to where you were after something inevitably happens. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So that's the debate today. Do you take the position of the only secure computer is one that's closed, turned off, locked away, put in a closet, disconnected from a network? Or do you, and in that model, get no risk? There's really no risk in that other than just staring at a computer locked in the closet. But or do you take the other stance of, hey, let's do some things. Some bad things are going to happen inevitably because you use it. And how do you make sure that you're ready for that when the time comes? Back in the debate again, as always, Eric Willey, Brian Schneebly, gentlemen, it's good to see you both.
Good to see you as well.
Good to see you too.
As you walk through that, it brought to mind to me kind of the debate between old school security and what most of us would call current security, right? You go back, old school security said, no, you can't do this. You can't click this. You can't have this new piece of software because it might be unsafe. So therefore, it's closer to being that if you shut down the computer, that's the only way we can be secure, to kind of the other side of the gamut, I think, where most of us are today and having conversations, right? Much like we're doing right now, and being able to understand components of the business, what are you trying to achieve, and all of those. Sounds like a kind of similar way to phrase that, if you will.
It does, but I think part of that evolution has come with the support of an organization around us. We have, we're parts of larger security organizations, or have been. And it's a lot easier to say, we've got a team of people working on backup, and we've got a team of people that can restore all the workstations. But you take this into the home, and you take this into the, your end user, your individual user, your brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers and aunts and uncles and friends, and they don't have those structures at home. And it puts a lot more concern on people. Did I click the wrong thing? I mean, to some extent, it's good to have that. People, there's awareness, but then there's also crippling fear.
Right.
And without the structures to support it, the crippling fear can take over. And the question is that okay? Is it okay to live a much more cautious lifestyle because you don't have the structures?
I would argue that the crippling fear, I don't think it's healthy. I don't think the crippling fear is healthy, but I get it, right? Because if you think, as we push the cripple, I shouldn't say we push the crippling fear, but as it becomes more pervasive and people start to distrust technology, doesn't that create an element of slowed innovation? That you should have a healthy fear of understanding. understanding of what the technology I'm using could do from a privacy aspect, from a technical aspect, and those things. But if all of a sudden we start to completely fear technology, do we snap back the other way and you stop getting any innovation that, that comes into the marketplace?
But is innovation always good? Innovation is interesting.
It's not intrinsic.
Innovation is it provides utility. But let's take this, as it always will go, let's take this into the privacy realm. Because I think it's a little more concrete when you look at information and data protection and data being accessed. Just because innovation is happening, just because there's a new thing or a new way to do it, do you really want to without understanding all the ramifications? Is it better to be more, I think it's in that case, it's better to be more cautious and understand it all the way. And a lot of those things are quite opaque. And if you bring it now back into security, you don't always know how things are going to go. You don't know what happens if I do this. So being more cautious can save you down the road. The question is the juice worth the squeeze? Is the benefit that you get from being more open worth the risks you put yourself through? And I'd argue for many people, it probably isn't.
Can I ask a quick question though? I think
that, Brian's here.
Yeah.
Hey, Brian.
Over here in the corner. I think it's a great question, great topic. But to reverse that just a little bit, because when you're talking about being cautious and also talking about some of that fear part of it, if you're also an organization or an enterprise, and this is just coming from the experiences I've seen, especially like in the last 6 months, if you're going to test a product though, and you're fearful of testing certain types of malware in your own environment, like, we're going to be cautious. We only want to do this. I only have an appetite for this. I only have an appetite for this. I think you're also setting yourselves up for what could be something really bad to happen. Meaning, yeah, we're not comfortable doing this, 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 and this. Okay. We're trying to set a priority of, if you're testing this type of a product, these are the things we think you should do, right? Kind of like a success criteria. Mm-hmm. And I say that from the vendor side, right? A success criteria. But the other part of that, I just know as of maybe even a month ago, getting into a conversation where I said, listen, I don't even understand how you can compare A, B, and C together because the only thing you tested against it was this. I go, that's not a true comparison. I go, that's not what a threat actor is going to do, right? And then how do you play that side of the coin? Because then it's like, is this guy sitting back there trying to scare me? Like, that's how some of it comes across. Like, oh, now he's trying to scare me. And that's not a good tactic to have. So I have to be so gentle on how I say it and even make sure I don't use the words you or me. I'm like in company name, Representative B, you know, like it's a fine line.
So it sounds like it would be kind of akin to, think of an automotive company builds a car and we're going to test that car, but we test it only on a dyno. We test it on a kind of a point rig to test the suspension. It's all done internally. Oh, but we never tested it out on the road. So we're going to launch it anyways, but we don't know how it's actually going to perform. I get some of that, but
I swear that is what happened.
Fair enough. We're not calling anybody out for it. But on the flip side though, me as a practitioner, I'd love to run something through its paces. What happens in the event that I choose that piece of malware that said tool doesn't catch, and I've now intentionally just launched something in my environment that causes possibly a disclosable event? What light does that paint me in? I kind of like having a job, and I feel like that is a career limiting move. So it's a tough line.
But again, just like anything, you can put additional protections in place when you go and do things like that to make sure that you don't, you know, that you have additional protections along the way. Put it into an isolated network, move these things away, you know, do it something that's completely disconnected, limit internet connectivity. There's a bunch of things you're going to do if you're going to play like that. But in the play and prepare world where you're going to, you know, you're going to isolate and do that kind of thing, you take the thought process, and then it's risk management in a different way. I'm consciously mitigating the fact I'm going to explode something that this endpoint protection may or may not cover.
Right.
But again, it comes back to the fact that you've got structures, you've got expertise, you've got access to technology that lets you overcome some of that crippling fear and lets you test and do.
I think it also comes back to, there is an element of what we do where it is not quantitatively perfect, right? When you look at testing. So if we look, let's look at a financial system. I can put in a new financial system and we can run in parallel. We can run the old, we can run the new, and we can flip. We can make sure that the statements that come out of there at the end flip, that they look the same, right? That's easily testable. It's repeatable and all those things. Think about, let's take an email filtering provider, right? Let's say we're going to try the same thing. We're going to run those in parallel. Maybe in parallel might wait. Actually, you really can't run them in parallel. Email is kind of single direction into a mailbox. But if you're going to alternate and say, I'm going to run this vendor for this month, this vendor for this month, and then pick a third one and run them, while those at a high level sound like the testing, okay, you know, we're giving each one a month, but they're not the same, right? That's the imperfect nature of information security, that, you know, as we've kind of talked about, the understanding the different threats towards a business, they change very rapidly. If I go back through our email filtering metrics, it'll shift from being attachment-based malware to being phishing and all of those. So if you catch a shift during your test in real-world applications, it's no longer apples to apples. And it comes down to its more interface, customizability, the fit for the actual organization. I think it's very hard to truly bake off solutions in information security when those solutions are sitting on the front lines detecting and defending networks.
Yeah, it's moment in time. It's, what are the attacks of the day? What are the researchers behind it that are, you know, that are working at that point in time? What's the thing that's happening that day? Right. And is that one that this will catch and this one won't, or, you know, will have an impact there? But I think that even would make a more compelling case for not a compelling case. I think it leads people back toward living in more fear of the unknown and saying, or the other side of the coin is they throw caution to them and I can't defend it anyway. I might as well, you know, it's so dynamic. It changes all the time. No matter what I do, it's not going to work, or right, it may not work. So whatever.
I feel like half of what I do, not professionally in terms of day-to-day trying to work with enterprises, but working with family and friends, is driving the fear part in, like telling stories. And I think I shared some of those too. Like when someone said, oh yeah, I reached out to et cetera nonprofit in trying to get my payment. And they shot me a note 4 days later to say, your bank came back and apparently it's fraudulent. And somewhere in between that email chain, somebody picked up the email and then replied right back as soon as he had sent it, just to say, hey, if it's easier, feel free just to go ahead and transfer it directly to my account. That account was said fraudulent, right? And he finds that out 3 to 4 days later. So like, I'm hearing this and then I have to back it up with like five more very gross stories, right? To try to like scare him just a little bit, like, hey, you should really be more cautious about X, Y, Z. You need to be doing this, you know. And his wife's looking at him like, you know, honey, see, I told you that's what we need to be doing. He's looking at me like, why are you saying this to me right now? You know? And I'm like, I'm just trying to drive the stake home a little bit. But that's what I'm doing, like with family and friends. Like, you really do need to be a little more cautious. And I know I bring it up again, wiser. I share those videos all the time with family and friends. Like, it's very easy. You know, I could sit there and sketch out for hours. It's very easy for them to see it. It's deliberate and boom, it paints a story. You put that in front of my child, boom, paints a story. Mm-hmm. Being in the security field, you can come back with, you know, a number of stories from any one of the conversations you have with another colleague or with said customer. And I can use those internally, you know, as long as it's not too far out there NDA wise, but tell my child X, Y, and Z, share a story and he gets it, right? But when it comes to the idea of the seat I sit in, you know, from a 9 to 5, let's say, and I'm talking to a customer, a smaller enterprise, let's say SMB account, and trying to explain why this would be important. It might have nothing to do with the solution I'm even offering. I'm just looking at the current state of affairs and he's telling me what they're currently using or doing. And I'm like, well, how are you doing this? You know, it's not even a product I sell. I'm like, you might want to look at that. You know what I mean? But I'm trying not to be pushy, right? Like then you come across as the guy that's trying to sell you everything. And I don't even sell those other three products I just told you about. I'm just looking at your current state of affairs and it doesn't look good.
Right.
Right.
And so much of it comes back to awareness. I think all roads lead back to education and awareness of people of where the middle of what they need to be aware of. But having been in this for 25 years, we started this field out with the sky is falling. And it didn't work so well. It was very much it got us what we needed at the time because it was people weren't as aware and it was, you know, if you don't do this, then bad guys can get in. And it worked, but we wore it out. We ended up not being able to go that route anymore to be able to defend purchases, defend
new security measures.
Exactly. And you get so much, you only get so much time of that. And we really had to evolve into education and awareness and learning and situational awareness of what's going on today. And hear this, and here's the measured risk. GDPR continues to be a great example. They talk about, you know, if you don't comply with GDPR, it could be 4% of your global turnover, of your global revenue. Could be. That's the worst that could happen. And people talk about that number because it's easy, it's scary. But the reality is, that's 4% if you do absolutely nothing, if you are negligent in what you do. But in reality, those numbers come way down. If you are taking due care, you have an issue, you didn't think about it, you can defend your decisions, all of those kinds of things. So the real risk number is much lower. And that's the place where we are in security as well, where you can talk, for years, we talked about the high end and we put people into a crippling fear state. Now it's about understanding more of the whole situation, people's complete lives in technology, and giving them the tools that they need to make smart decisions, the insights they need to make smart decisions, and at least not take the action that will immediately turn them into a victim.
I think it's also a little bit, when I say complicated, if you asked a 12-year-old, how do you prevent or how do you keep yourself from getting AIDS or HIV? He can probably sit there and explain to you pretty well how to prevent that based on the education that he's received, and it happens in school. If I ask that same 12-year-old, how do you prevent ransomware? They'd probably look over at mom and dad and go, not open bad emails. You know, like that's one thing that he's been told. But outside of that, I mean, he wouldn't understand the myriad of different ways that can happen. Right. Or even how the computer works that he gets on, you know, or the tablet that he plays on, or let alone the fact that when he gets on mom or dad's computer to go do something, that there's other risks there. You know, it's just, it goes back to the idea of education starting at a younger age of what to be concerned with. So let's talk fear factor. Is that driving fear? Or is that driving education? Because you could say
on when you start it. If you start it young, it becomes part of their natural course of expectation, and they build it in. For people who start it older, who are, you know, later, who it's a newer topic in their life, they're going to see it and they're going to seize.
Yeah. Take, for example, I was just about to say the idea of masks. You need to wear a mask. Not in my home, not when I'm doing this. It's the same thing when you give them a computer. Yeah. I'm cautious at work because that's their computer. Then I get home, it's still their computer. And what are you doing when you're at home? It's not like somebody was ever looking over your shoulder there and now you're sitting at home doing God knows what.
Having just finished a security awareness campaign and an annual training exercise, it became, it was interesting to watch the reactions because people were very much, enlightened by the things they saw, things that we take for granted as practitioners, things we see and think about all the time. But there was really enlightenment as you brought these things to a wider audience to say, a do this, don't do this, keep an eye out for this. This is where you, this is who you tell. And it was really delightful, because then you, as soon as you put it into personal terms, into the rest of their lives, as well as their work life, it takes on a whole new meaning, a whole new sense of purpose, because now you're also helping them with their own home finance, protect their own home finances, protect their personal identity, protect their family. Those kind of things are really valuable, and those pay dividends as they come back into the workplace as well. But it is clear to me that people have long been given the fear answer: don't do this or bad things will happen. Right. Whereas I think the more measured approach, the enlightened approach, the academic approach of informing and giving situations and along the continuum of risk really does make for a more informed and more responsible user.
So Eric, would you say that part of what he just said was, I teach them very delicately so that they fear a little bit what they're going, because at some point it's, you don't do this because you fear what the repercussions are, or you don't do this because I understand what the repercussions are. Do you think Dan is teaching them in a very lightened manner so that they've learned the lesson not to do it, or they also fear the lesson not to do it?
I mean, the learn versus fear, I mean, there's an element to it that is instilling a little bit of fear, no matter which route you go, right? That there has to be a little fear that if I do X, Y could happen, right? There is that element, but I do agree with the reframing of it. Instead of being, it's having the conversation and understanding of why, rather than just, hey, here's the set of rules, just follow these rules. We've tried that. We've tried the 10 commandments of security in the past. I don't want to say they don't work, but they're not great. They're not as good as they could be. But having the conversation,
they just do them. They don't understand why.
Correct. But all of a sudden you reframe it to at home that, hey, if you do this, somebody could steal your social security number and become you, could take money from your bank account, could charge your credit cards. All of a sudden the light comes on. Oh man, that has a real impact to me. I understand that. I know somebody who had to work on getting their identity back, and wow, that was a lot of time they had to put it. I don't want to be that person. So, all right, I now understand that. I'm going to take these steps to try to protect myself, because I don't want to be in that position down the road. I think that's highly effective. I think is getting away from the training, so back into the enterprise, getting away from all of the education being around protecting the enterprise, and hey, we're just going to help you as an employee protect you. And if you help somebody protect themselves, that becomes ingrained in who they are, and they bring that back in. So it's the same thing like you guys are talking about doing it in school, right? If you train somebody from a younger age on how to protect themselves online and all of that, and I do think some of this is happening, probably not as much as it should be, but it's starting to get there. I do think that that will help in the long run, but being the cautious side of it, I think it is limited because of the change in the attack vectors, the change in technology. You know, the analogy you used, Brian, on some of the classes that a younger kid will take, and you know, sex ed and all of that, by and large, the mechanics there don't change, right? On technology, it's always evolving. What you learned yesterday may not be applicable tomorrow. So it's got to constantly be evolving with it. And I think that makes it a little bit more challenging, but not insurmountable.
The other thing I'd add to that is that we have a, you also have to help people understand the things that actually may apply to them. You know, back to the risk management mindset, you know, chances are as an individual, a nation state isn't going to be coming after you for APT. If you are, you're probably in a role in which you know and expect that. But your average school teacher, your average line worker, is not going to be the target of those kinds of attacks. They should be aware of them, but not living in fear of them. But everyone is potentially a target for phishing. Everyone is potentially a target for account compromise. and you know, helping them understand, I fall into this bucket. I probably don't fall into this bucket. And then again, helps them realize that there's shades in the middle between fully closed, turned off, and in the closet, and you know, devil may care attitude.
Right. And yeah. I think we can continually draw back on the fear that needs to be instilled. As I think about it, back to your story, Brian, on the bank account where somebody was phished and then trying to reroute funds, right? I think that's an awesome example of defense in depth. We've been talking about this for the longest time and having different controls. Now, in this case, it's a multi-org defense in depth, right? Email filtering failed, but the bank caught it. That's awesome. And those are growing more and more. And I think, coming back to what I said earlier on, I think we've got to dwell on that and understand that moving away from the security of yesterday and being technical focused and all of that, and the controls, and more process focused, right? That was a business process on the bank's part that said, ooh, I'm seeing funds go here. That doesn't look good. Granted, all right, there's a technical element to it. But I think as security practitioners, back to having conversations with people, it's got to be process focused. Because if we continue to focus on technology, 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 we're going to fail. And having the conversations, when you have a conversation from somebody outside of the business realm, just going into the personal realm altogether. And I want to say it was you, Brian, at one point that kind of like, and you were talking to somebody about a wireless network, right? You know, if you think about it in terms of having a guest network or having a good password on your wireless network, you know, would you leave your door open? Would you allow a stranger to just come into your house? Well, by setting a bad password on your wireless network, somebody could be standing outside right now and they're technically in your house because they're connected to your network, which runs through your walls, right? So having that conversation, putting it in real world terms that somebody understands, I think we can start getting away from this hyper tech focused and nerding out on here's all the technical controls and reasons behind why you need to be secure, and reframe it to help in personal terms.
Sure. Yeah, totally agree. What you just said, and I know we talked about that before, it'd be like the same thing of when you lose your wallet. Up until the point where you actually know you lost your wallet, you haven't worried about it at all, right? Like, and then the second you realize you don't have your wallet, you're like, it could be in the car. Before I panic, I'm going to go check the car, right? And then it's like, I'm going to check everywhere before I have to cancel anything, because the process of canceling stuff takes a long time. And I don't want to cancel it and then find it all and be like, oh, I shouldn't have done that, right? But between the time you actually realize that maybe this was actually missing for more than 24 hours, and if it really was lost, somebody could have been using those credit cards, right? And that's why you cancel. Oh, go ahead, Dan.
I'll say, but that mode of thinking applies because the risks, now it applies to credit cards, not debit cards. If I had a wallet full of debit cards where I don't have recourse and the money doesn't get refreshed, I would probably take a bit of a different stance. Credit cards in the US, I have very little liability. Outside the US, very different rules on liability. So it's a risk decision. Your point is it's a risk decision, but we understand what the risks are, and that's how we go into the calculation. It's a perfect analogy.
Yep. And where I was going to go with that too was the whole idea that if somebody understands that feeling, right, when you realize you lost your wallet, right? It's similar with the cell phone, but more so with the wallet. It's like, you know, especially let's say you had a check in there, some cash in there. It's everything bing, 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 and you're going through your head, what did I have in there? That should be the same way when you instill the conversation. And this goes to the consumer level. Like you said, you're not being targeted by nation states, et cetera, but you're still being targeted by certain people. They're going to go and fish anybody. And if they can get your identity and use your identity to go do something bad, they'll do that. I mean, it's very easy. Like, oh, Brian Schneebly, he left this wide open. I'm going to grab his identity. Can't make it into his bank account, but I can use this to go set this up. And I'm going to then use his name and just start billing this or grabbing this. And next thing you know, like you're being asked questions of, did you do this? And you're like, I don't know what you're talking about. Right. And then the second that light bulb goes off, it's like the losing your wallet part. yes, I literally just lost my identity. All these bad things just happen, right? And that's what I was trying to compare it to. Like when you have a conversation, like how do you make the person make it feel real, make it something that's tangible that they can, you know, that touch, smell, feel part where it's like, but part of that is instilling a little bit of fear. You're educating, but you're putting in a scenario where the feeling that they had was, you know, I was so scared when I lost my wallet. So yes, I am putting a little bit of that fear in, but I'm doing it for all the right reasons.
So then it sounds like going back to the original question that Dan posed, fear can be enough. And that becomes a defensible position that instead of having to do all of the playbooks and run through and understand if this, then we're going to do this. But if I just have the fear, put it in the terms of a small business, right? The SMB space. That if I just have fear of doing something wrong, but I know that it's capped repercussions down the road, that, you know, the credit versus debit card, right? If it's if my credit card gets hit, well, they'll get rid of the charges and I'll just go on. They'll give me a new card and nothing happens, right? The bank is going to catch that fraudulent wire transfer. And if those are contained, it's contained risk there. Maybe fear is enough. Maybe that is enough for a small, medium business that maybe I'll just do some of the basics and just, all right, I just got to make sure I got an MFA on some of my accounts. I got a good password. Cool. I don't have to go through and set up all these playbooks for what happens for ransomware, what happens for all these different things. And that's not a risk I'm worried about.
Well, and I think that actually leads into a really nice set of the next set of topics around what can people do to reduce the chance, you know, while they're using technology in a more open way, they have an appropriate amount of fear, an appropriate amount of cautiousness. Let's not say fear, cautiousness, because they understand the things that can and can't happen. They're out using technology. What are some of the kind of things that people can put in place to protect themselves for if, or more likely when, something happens? Ransomware occurs, somebody gets in and starts deleting data, they access email, business email, or email compromise, those kinds of things. Where either prevent protections to prevent them or reduce the chance of them happening, or increasing the recoverability once it does?
I mean, for me, and I just kind of mentioned it, I think step one, where you can set up MFA, set up MFA.
What's MFA?
For anybody listening, multi-factor authentication. So we typically see this play out that I go to sign on to my bank's website and they either ask me for a code or it says, hey, I'm going to send you an email or a text. Here's a code, put it back in the website to prove that you are who you are. Is it infallible? No, you can game that, but it's not exactly easy. If somebody's trying to game that part of it, you've got a pretty big target on your back. So that aside, MFA is highly, highly effective. And where you can turn it on, and frankly, if you come across a web service, a website that doesn't have MFA, that should raise a red flag. All of the best companies now have MFA enabled. Most of them don't allow you to get away from it. You have to use it by default, and that's for a good reason. So that overcomes some of our bad password settings and other bad habits that we've had for a long time. It's a really good technology.
At the risk of introducing fears of people that they didn't already know about, you know, there's a lot of issues with SIM swapping. A lot of MFAs use text messaging, SMS, to send you a one-time PIN that you enter after you've authorized, after you've done your password, or even before sometimes. But there's been a lot of discussion about issues with mobile phone companies being able to take and swap out a SIM, say, this is my new SIM number. They move the phone number over to the bad actor. Then they can get the code and get into the
account. So real quick, Dan, what does a SIM do for the phone?
A SIM is the identity of the phone. It's a subscriber information module, subscriber identity module of the two. But it's the chip inside your phone.
So essentially, if I copy Dan's SIM, I become Dan's phone.
Right. Or would you change the number? You don't even copy the SIM. You call the phone company and say, new SIM number is this. It moves the identity of my phone number to their phone instead of mine. And there have been cases where people have awakened and their phone has no signal because the SIM has been moved to a different person's phone. And then they get the 2FA code and they go in it.
And but, I will add, it's not, this is not ethereal. I have legitimately close to us seen this attack play out. It does happen.
So then the question is, you know, and there's among security pundits, you'll hear a lot of us talking about that that SMS shouldn't be used for two-factor. But my question to you is which is worse, no 2FA or SIM is 2FA or SMS as 2FA, which would you rather have?
I'd go SMS over nothing.
Yeah.
Again, the technical attack to go through and actually get somebody to change the account. And by the way, with your phone companies and stuff like that, I believe some of them have now moved to, you can give them a code that you have to have before you can change anything on your account. So you can even do some semi MFA there. Granted, it's something you know along with who you are.
Right. But it's not a perfect process yet.
No, it's not. But I would still go SMS over nothing every day of the week. The better one, in my opinion, is when you have the actual app on your phone. You see this play out. Microsoft's got a flavor of this. Duo. There's a number of different companies out there that have an app that goes right on your phone. And you know, I think Google was one of the first ones to start this. When you log into your account, now instead of me having to go get a code or anything like that, it pops up on my phone, or actually even better, on my Apple Watch, and says, "Hey, are you trying to log in?" And I can click to authenticate right there. They are becoming much, much more friction-free.
Yeah, I was just about to
taking the debate out of it. Always use 2FA if it's available. Always use 2FA or MFA, two-factor authentication. Now it's evolving to MFA, multi-factor authentication.
And tomorrow we'll change the term again.
Yeah, and I wanted to throw out the whole part about friction, because when you said the whole SMS, the idea is you're putting in a little bit of friction to help prevent bad stuff from happening. But then the idea of putting the friction in, how do we make the friction be less frictionless, right? And what's the easiest way to do it, but without making it easy for the threat actor to also do it and overcome that, right? And I think that's where it becomes almost habit stance. If I know that something is going to pop up that I have to do 2FA or MFA, I prefer to do it from my phone, because when it populates the message, all I have to do is go back to that site and that code is already populated, where if I did it on my computer, I have to then type it in by hand.
Right.
So literally all I have to do is click. And the first few times I did that, I was like, that seemed too easy. Right. But then it's like, I really enjoy the too easy part.
But now let's to bring the debate portion back into it. I was having a discussion the other day with somebody who was recounting an experience in which they were doing an investigation. They went to the user, and the person had the attacker had stolen the username and password. That auto pushed a message that said the 2FA in the multi-factor app said, "Do you agree or not?" And the person actually clicked agree, like, "Yes, I'm confirming this." They hadn't put the username and password in. It was an attacker. And they just let the attacker in, because you know why? Because we get used to clicking, we get used to doing this behavior, and we just do it by rote. It's too easy. Is it too easy in those cases?
Yeah, that's it's a very interesting perspective. I get that. I just because it could happen, and we could have fatigue, and could let somebody in. Now, I think that's been exacerbated by the work from home. Because I think it's the whole MFA thing prompts much more now that we're out and remote as well as it should. But I don't think that's a driver to not do it. You know, maybe there becomes different ways to look. In all honesty, I think that comes back to education, Dan. You know, I think that's one of the things that maybe we haven't done as a community real well, to say, all right, we gave you MFA, do it everywhere. Okay, now there's another component about it. Hey, if you, that MFA thing, you remember what I told you, that was great, use that. But by the way, if it pops up and you weren't trying to log into something, bad. No. Stay away from that. That means somebody else.
Remember, Eric. I say that with hyperbole, but in reality, it is a lot for people to remember. Yeah. As they're doing their jobs, as they're doing, you know, they're browsing and communicating with grandma. There's just a lot of things to have to remember in order to stay safe.
Right.
And it's tough. tough as in it is difficult, not if you don't like it, that's tough.
Right.
The other thing I want to talk about is backup. It's not a fun topic. It's not a pretty topic, but it's one that I guess I'm a little fearful that people aren't taking quite as seriously for a couple of reasons. One, people have tended to assume that cloud or cloud services equal backup, that I'm putting this into iCloud, I'm putting this into OneDrive, and therefore it is backed up. Safe to assume that or not?
No, because if you think about it, yeah, I think I do agree with you that a lot of people all of a sudden, well, it's in the cloud, it's backed up, it's on Google, it's on all those things, and that all of a sudden means it's there in perpetuity. But I agree with you that I think that is the thought, but that's not really what happens, right? It's a lot of us, so back into the enterprise, thinking about distributed databases, right? That we always said, well, we replicate the data over to another data center into that database, therefore it's backed up and secure. No. What happens if I change the data over here? What happens if I encrypt on the left side? That's just gonna propagate to the right side, and I now own both sides.
I have highly available corrupted data.
Right.
Highly available corrupted data. I like right. that.
So it's the same thing. You brought up the Apple Cloud, right? That sure, if your phone completely dies and you sever the tie at that point in time, okay, your pictures are backed up, you've got some stuff there. But anything that propagates, if I delete on one side, it'll delete there. So if I attack the phone in that aspect, or if I encrypt here, it's just gonna back up an encrypted, a ransomware version of that file. Now, granted, some of them have more granular controls to roll back and versioning, but that's going down the rabbit hole.
I was talking with, and this also goes to something we've discussed before, was, at what level of trust do you have with, really small startup companies that have really, really cool ideas and things that they're doing, like where are they at with their technology? And when you're talking about backups and data and how do you protect that and keep things running, I actually came across a very interesting small company that was doing really, really unique things, I would say like maybe 3 months ago. And I immediately tried introducing them to our team internally, not for the sake that we were trying to sell their technology, but like, I think this is something we should be using. I think this is something that, guys, take a look at this. Like, is it as good as it sounds? And they looked at it and our engineers immediately said, this is very, very cool. Like, wow, this is awesome. But Brian, they're a really small company. And my response back was, yeah, but we were once a really, really small company. We're still not the biggest of companies, right? We're small. It's like, yeah, but Brian, they're small. And I was like, so you're going back to when you talk about trust. Now there's that fear side of you have these small companies doing really cool things. Who's going to be the first one to take a chance on them? And in talking with these guys, there's some universities that are working with them, which I thought was really cool. And it's when you talk about backups and what they're doing with data, I don't want to jump in and actually even touch on exactly what they're doing, because I'll probably misstep like 3 or 4 times. But let's just say they're building out like your own basic cloud for you. They replace your hypervisor. And I'm throwing out terms that the average listener right now is probably like, did he just say that? Hypervisor.
Like, I wear a hypervisor when I'm golfing.
Right. And they show how they do this, how they roll back and how quick they can replace like your virtual machine, right? Your VM and what they're doing. And the reason I started this conversation with them is one of our very large customers, where they stop is kind of where our product began. And I had to like reach out and have the conversation afterwards, like, explain to me exactly what it is you guys are doing, because that seemed really cool. And when you guys brought up the protecting of data today, that's like the first thing that popped in my head was like, this is what they were doing. And they were doing it with a very large university here in the state of Michigan, which it came to my
attention. I wouldn't trust any of those universities, just saying. Oh, sorry, Dan. Just point.
Too much research happening at these universities.
Very, very academic, non-real world. I don't.
But and I guess, Eric, you work for a large corporation, large enterprise. you come across a company like this that's doing really cool things, what's the first thing you do? Do you say, oh, I'm going to bring you in and test this? Or do you then call somebody to say, hey, have you heard of this company? Right. And I think the problem with that is half the people that we call also have in their back pocket something that they're already trying to sell, right?
Right. Or
that they lean towards, right? There's, and I found that, like, I, you know, moving from the automotive space into this space, there's 1,000 different people doing this in security, right? And they love the fact that people talk about layered approach. They're like, yes, because I got 20 of those 50 layers I can give you.
I could sell more insertion.
So to answer your question, though, I'm phoning a friend on those. But that's just me and the enterprise and the team I have, right? As I look at my peers around the industry, there's a couple, you know, reaching out to Dan, and there's some others that I know have a little bit more capacity and look at some of those newer tools that I trust that can do the technical deep dive on it. I look at it not just for my own team, but what I can give back to the smaller company. And smaller companies need help with feedback and direction and trial and error. I don't have that type of capacity. So it becomes kind of a lose-lose to do something in the enterprise. Now, we've got other smaller companies within the overall umbrella where we can do some of those things, and maybe that becomes a fit. By and large, I lean on some of my peers.
If only there were universities that had environments that could be isolated and test these things and research and find out how they could work. You know, it's a great concept.
So Dan, do you say then there that you phone a friend as well?
Of course. I don't know one perspective. The best advice I ever got from a mentor was get lots of perspectives. Yeah. But at the same time, you do run the risk of entering a filter bubble where you end, you're asking the same people the same questions, and you end up building up one altogether, sort of building up one path, and you may be leaving out others. But I think it's worth looking broadly across the space and looking at options that exist, even in places that have become kind of utility, where there's or commodity, where there's 20 and they're all about the same. It's worth looking at them more than just, oh, everybody's buying this one, so let's use, that must be the best one for now, let's use it. You can make kingmakers that way. But
transitioning back on the backups, throw this over to you, Dan. What would be a recommendation that you would give to an SMB when thinking about backups? What to back up, where to back up?
I think SMBs and individuals, at home, I think there was an old adage, and I'm going to see if I can find the exact details on it. It was 3-2-1. I think it still applies. Let me get the specifics. 3-2-1 backup. It was like having three different copies locally, and let me get to the actual. Yeah. Okay. So two on-site backups and one off-site backup. An off-site backup doesn't necessarily mean cloud, doesn't necessarily mean the active cloud, a separate backup. You know, in the enterprise, we talk about, who's backing up Office 365? I don't know. Most people don't. Who's Office backing up your Salesforce instance?
Right.
And the same thing applies to who's backing up your iCloud. I was having an issue just yesterday and into this morning with my iCloud. I'm running beta software for Mac OS, and the iCloud was just not syncing on this device. And had that clenchy moment of, I'm about to disable this, and which means it purges it all locally. So what's going to happen? Is the sync going to fail? Is it going to start removing things from the actual cloud service? So before doing it, I took a full copy of it from a computer that was working right. So I had a full backup of all of the data before doing any of this work. So, it's two copies on site, usually one in your one in the place you're operating, one in a different site. So if there's a fire or if there's a flood or something, and that backup copy's gone, and then one that is either cloud-based or fully remote, that's not just the operational cloud.
To tag on to that, for the offsite piece, you know, I'll throw out a caution on that. I've seen a lot of small businesses that say, all right, for an offsite, what we're going to do is we're going to take it back up and we're going to give it to, we're going to change what employee has it. And that employee is going to take it home for the day just so it's offsite. Be careful. Be careful. While it checks the box for being offsite, number one, things are easily lost. And if that gets out, what does that do to your company? Number two, think about the vertical you're in. I'm pretty sure as we get in, I'm no HIPAA expert, but as you get into some of the personal data governed by HIPAA, that cannot be unencrypted sitting on a drive in somebody's car or somebody's home. So understand your vertical, understand the controls that are in place, and make sure that that's a great place that to get some advice from somebody that knows your industry pretty well on how you can meet those control objectives cost effectively.
Yep. And I was going to add, not kind of like an argument there, but I also think this is where the board becomes pretty mission critical, right? Because we talked about fear, training, talked about backing up, et cetera. But when the board can understand that and you have access to the board, or the right person has access to the board to be able to explain these things, and do so in the manner that we were just talking about. You're not throwing fear into the wind and just hoping that they're downstream and it's hitting them in the face and like, blah, 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 blah. Yes, I fear this. It's that education part, right? Like talking about losing the wallet. What does that feel like, right? What was that feeling that you had when you realized somebody just used your credit card? I was upset, and B, I told myself I'm never losing that wallet. I'm not taking it out of my pocket. I'm not setting it down, right? You're instantly thinking the things you're not going to do. I'm going to protect this situation, right? This is backing up your data, right? This is protecting that somebody doesn't get their hands on it. And it's explained to, if the board can understand that, you don't have to train 50,000 employees exactly on that. Then the board's backing up everything you're doing. And then when it's driven from the top down, it helps, right? When it,
absolutely.
When the top understands what your objective is and they're on board with the objective, people follow, right? It's.
I loved how emotional you got on that. You're pounding the fist on the desk. I was waiting for none shall pass.
It's it. Yeah. Boom. So I just wanted to throw that in because in a previous role or previous life, I know if you wanted to get certain things done or you had certain ideas, right? If the top agreed with you, right, then from the top down, things seem to move that much faster. And I definitely find that in my new role, talking with security experts, if you really want to put certain things in place or get the business on board, right, top down. It's the same thing at home with families, right? Like if, you know, the matriarch or patriarch of the house totally agrees, certain things start to go into place, right? Yeah. And until that happens, until there's an understanding, then it's not going to happen. So the education part's key. Part of that education, I think, is the idea of fearing partially the unknown, right? Knowing what it is, but not knowing, you know, who the people are behind the scenes, who those threat actors are. You don't have to know their names. All you have to know is that, yeah, there's some scary stuff out there. This stuff does happen. My mom just asked me, I want to say a week ago, love my mother to death. I just want to make sure we have that on the record there in case she's listening. Love you, Mom.
I think we can make the safe assertion. We all love our mothers.
Very true.
And keep that part in there too, Dan, so we can share this later. She said to me, Brian, she goes, how do I keep all my information from being searched? I go, what do you mean? She goes, well, I looked up my name, you know, on Google. And she goes, and there's a bunch of information out there about me. I'm like, what kind of information? You know, and it's not bad stuff. You know, it's like, you know, almost back to like when she was like graduating high school, you know, like all the different awards she's ever gotten, anytime that she was mentioned, you know, in the company she worked for. And she goes, I just don't want a lot of that stuff out there. I'd rather that people just can't look me up and find all of that. And I had to kind of back up and explain to her, like, all of that's available. I go, you'd actually be surprised the stuff that you're not seeing on this web that's on the dark web about you. You know what I mean? Like, that's only the stuff you see, right? But the people that really want to do bad stuff, they're not looking for, you know, when you got an award at work, right? They're looking for your social security number. They're looking for your home address and a way to figure out when you're in town and out of town.
Right.
Yeah. There's
GDPR cover the dark web? Does that work? I don't know.
there's a whole level. You bring up an interesting topic, Brian, and maybe one for another episode, around the legitimate, and I use that word in quotes, the legitimate legal data collection efforts that are out there. I did a talk for the Metropolitan New York Library organization, Metro, a couple of weeks ago around some of that, you know, how data is collected, how it's gathered, how it's correlated. And it's a really, it's really interesting that, and what your mother saw is a representation of a small piece of that data, but it's all being collected through legal means. This is not even getting into the into the attacker scenario. There's just a treasure trove of information being collected and shared and sold about all of us. You know, and here in the US, this is all okay. And it's very difficult to get your data out of it. But it can happen. It's very manual, very laborious. And you have to go to about 300 different places and say, opt me out.
I think that's a great topic. Maybe not for today, because there are literally companies that have been built on the idea of being able to go through and create the analytics on, you know, 28, 32 different verticals of human beings by age class, by ethnicity, et cetera. And they're doing all that, but are they storing it safe? So you can talk about backups. You could almost say that they become a prime target of somebody that would say, hey, they just did all this work for me on 32 million individuals. That's a Trevor Trove, you know, treasure trove of information that I want to go after.
They have been a target. I mean, sure. If you look at some of the ones doing it for politics.
Arian, Equifax.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm hearing Privacy Drone 2.0 for our next episode. We'll get back to it.
Privacy Drone 2, the legal side.
There you go.
Legal, but should it be?
I think Brian hit on something key too, jumping back on the top-down approach, right? If you're a business owner, leader listening to this, first of all, thank you. You know, we really appreciate you listening. Throw us any topics, anything you want to talk about. But you have to care about security. You may not have to understand everything, but you have to care. And you have to care enough that if you don't understand, ask. You know, we got three people on here that feel free, shoot us some questions. We'll have a conversation, or we can connect you with somebody that knows somebody, something better in your given vertical. If you don't know, ask, because it's part of being a business now. To be a business, you have to be able to protect customer employee information. It's the new bar. You have to be so tall to ride, and it's part of business. So I think that was a great point, Brian, because I've seen, even in large enterprises, I think we can all call out certain CISOs out there that still don't have the top-down buy-in, and it's brutal. It's painful watching those companies, watching those people deal.
It is, and I think that if you do have interest in getting in touch, feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net is the email address, or our website, greatsecuritydebate.net. On Twitter, Security Debate. I think that's all. We have LinkedIn as well, but you know, if you can find us there, feel free to use it. And with that, I think we're going to have to close for today. Another great discussion. Thank you so much, Eric and Brian, and thanks to you for listening. Please do feed us back with additional information, additional thoughts, ideas for future episodes. If you have questions, we really just want to help share and pass on the security expertise. We probably won't debate with you in email, but we will definitely give you get you to the right person or help get you the insights you need. Thanks again for joining us. Have a great week, and we'll be back soon with another great security debate.